This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Grammy Awards, it's the music industry's big night. In 1984, the 26th annual Grammy Awards was super huge. It's notable for garnering the biggest Grammy Awards television audience ever, with just under 52 million viewers. Michael Jackson, who had been recovering from scalp burns sustained due to an accident that occurred during the filming of a Pepsi commercial, won a record 8 awards during the show. Michelangelo Matos has taken a hard look at this year of hits and this particular time in America in which they were minted. He's the author of Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year.
The main reason is that so much was happening at once. A lot of things were taking shape that year. Things that had already been going on crystallized that year, and it was also a very sort of pivotal year in terms of some of the underground things that would later become the mainstream. So you had 84 as a climactic year for a lot of people who'd been in the business a long time, people like Prince and Bruce Springsteen. Michael Jackson obviously sort of bestrode the whole thing like a colossus. But again, he had been at it for a long time too. Tina Turner, who had her great comeback that year, was somebody, sort of the definition of an artist who'd been around for a really long time and done lots of vital work, but was only starting to be recognized for its totality in 84. And then you have things like Run-DMC's rise, R.E.M.'s rise, things like that, where you have these, you know, outsider styles like hip hop and indie rock that are starting to like nudge into the mainstream. Did you never call? Waited for your calls, rivers of suggestion to drive me away. The trees will bend, the cities wash away, the city on the river becomes a girl.
We talk about the 80s.
Yes.
And you're focusing on 84. Now, the 80s is one of those decades where it's very different. 1981, we're still wearing leisure suits. And then we get into 89, and that's completely different as well. It's important that we kind of focus on that year. But in your book, and then we think about 84, there's not exactitude about what classifies as an 84 song, is there?
It has a couple of meanings because in one thing that happened is that a lot of the early 80s stuff from Britain in particular didn't really get heard in America for a year or two after it had been a hit in Britain, thanks to MTV. So, for example, Don't You Want Me had already been like the Christmas number one of 1981 in Britain, but it didn't become a number one in America until, I think, the summer of 82. That was sort of a sea change. You had a lot of songs that had their American impact in 84, but were hits earlier. Another good example of that actually is Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight, which had already been a top 40 American hit when it came out in 1981, but it was really a hit, and not really a hit, it didn't do as well again, it didn't chart as highly again, but it became more part of the fabric of the culture after appearing on the first episode of Miami Vice.
How much time we got? 25 minutes.
Miami Vice was, the rumor went around for many years that it was invented because an NBC executive wanted something with MTV cops in it. It was already in the works before that, but Miami Vice was a really pivotal show in the way that it used music, used recordings, well-known recordings of music, as part of the ambience and background of the scenes, and scored many of its scenes to those songs. In the Air Tonight, especially, was scored to this very moody scene in the opening episode of Miami Vice, and that gave it a new currency.
No. Hello.
Caroline?
Sonny?
I need to know something, Caroline. The way we used to be together. I don't mean lately, but before. It was real, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You bet it was. Sonny, what's wrong?
Nothing, Caroline.
Miami Vice is the 80s. If you want any TV show that represented the 80s, it's that one.
And that was because they were concerned about visuals, they were concerned about pacing. And
they made it like a film. It was Michael Mann who had made movies, and he was obviously a very stylish director. One of the things that they said when they were making the show is that they were not allowed to use earth tones. So they had this very pastel-heavy tonal palette, including in the outfits the characters wore, that both, you know, it was apt for the setting, and it was also very, very cutting edge. Like, nothing like that had ever been on TV. Nothing looked like that on TV. It immediately stood apart. So they were also, even more to the point, I think, with the book, they used music, they used recordings, well-known recordings, not like cover versions or whatever. That was rare. You didn't see that very much in prime time at all at that point. You would maybe have like a guest appearance by a singer doing their hit on a sitcom. But you didn't have dramas that were scored to rock music. That was totally new.
So 1984, though, was it a reaction to what was happening around the nation and the world at the time? Was the music a particular response to, say, the economics?
It actually was a robust year for the economy. Things were doing extremely much better by 84. The early 80s recession had mostly subsided by the end of 83. So it was boom time. People in America particularly were just like, it was a consumer paradise. And there's a lot of stuff in the book about that, about, you know, the skyrocketing sales figures of consumer goods. And a lot of that was, of course, associated with the music business, because a lot of those consumer goods were to play records and tapes. Cassettes outsold LPs for the first time that year. And the compact disc is rearing its head as well. So it's a huge year technologically for both making music, because there's a brand, you know, there's a lot of equipment that's starting to come into common usage in the recording studio, and also in terms of just the selling of records. Like, record sales hit an all-time high in 84. And that was, you know, a function of its comeback, because the business had nearly been bankrupted in 1979. Sales took a huge downturn that year. The record business lost 11% in sales in 1979. And it was the first reversal, never mind a large reversal, which that is, but any kind of reversal had been almost unheard of in the record business, because ever since World War II, it had been on a steady upward incline. It wasn't going down at all. So by 79, when that happens, the record business is shattered and it has to retool. And the ways it retools are a lot of what this book is about. It's about how they learned to, you know, make albums that were all blockbuster material rather than just like two or three hit singles at the most. That became the sort of law of the land in that era.
We're taking a break, back with more breaking down the pop music of 1984 when we come back. 1984 was a big year for girls who just want to have fun. This is Cyndi Lauper's breakout smash. It was number 15 on the year's Billboard Hot 100. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm talking to Michelangelo Matos, author of Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. It was in 1984 that Michael Jackson's album Thriller started something. Start off the book writing about how radio stations found themselves almost in a crisis, that old format was no longer working for them, and they needed to reinvent their playlist. So what was the process?
What had happened during the 70s is that what had been for a long time top 40 radio, which, you know, the philosophy of top 40 radio was play the hits in regular rotation. And that was it. And then in the 70s, you had all of these different formats come to fore. You had Adult Contemporary, or AC, which is where people who wanted to hear Barry Manilow ballads could just hear Barry Manilow ballads. And then in the late 70s, there was disco radio, which sort of took a segment of that market share along with it. It was really only popular on the coasts. The one we're talking about here is AOR, album-oriented rock, as it was called then. And that was what would eventually become classic rock. It was album cuts rather than singles. So the stations would just play tracks off LPs, but they weren't playing singles. They weren't playing 45s. And they didn't use a lot of the same things that had been part and parcel of Top 40 radio. It was a reaction against Top 40 radio. So Top 40 radio had been very hyper, very full of jingles and, you know, little squibs of sound, just hyper and appealing to a teenage audience. And AOR, as it evolved, was against that. They played long album cuts. The DJs were laid back. There was no pretense. There was no hyperness. Then the early 80s happens and the record business is in the dump. Albums aren't selling. The two things that come along are MTV in 1981, which immediately stimulates sales in all the places that it, you know, comes onto cable, which takes a while for it to come. Like, it takes at least 2 years to actually be on cable in New York, where they're headquartered. And then Michael Jackson's Thriller is released in December of 82, and that album does so well along with MTV. And then, of course, once Michael Jackson's on MTV, it helps pull the entire business out of its slump. People are excited about music and albums again. And that leaves AOR in a bad spot because in the late 70s, when punk and new wave came along, for the most part, AOR rejected it. They didn't want to play those bands. And then by the early 80s, those are the bands that are getting onto MTV, or their successors are. And suddenly, in 83, you have a situation where these album rock stations are losing their audiences. The only people they seem to appeal to are young men. They don't appeal to women. They don't appeal to older audiences. There is a sea change at a number of these stations where they are suddenly forced to contend with MTV by adding Michael Jackson and Prince and Culture Club to their playlist and de-emphasizing the oldies. A huge backlash, which is the subject of the first chapter. I found an amazing air check of WPLJ in New York City. They had done this. They had changed their format. And the air check was of the program director reading these absolutely furious letters from their listeners. These, you know, rock and rollers who didn't want to hear anything other than hard rock.
On WPLJ, New York, time for a special edition of Let's Hear It with our program director, Larry Berger.
We ended up at WPLJ, I guess, in 1979 into 1980, playing, I guess you could define our format at that time. We played only records by white people with long hair who played electric guitars. When we first started playing Michael Jackson, the phones went crazy, and there were threats and petitions, and that went on for, I guess, about 2 or 3 weeks. And then after about a month, it became one of our most requested and our most popular records that we had ever had on our radio station.
So you had a very influential program director decide, we've got to figure out a new way. How did they decide that this was going to be the new vein that they were going to mine?
The numbers weren't lying. MTV was doing extremely well by programming this more synthesizer-led music, less direct, in-your-face guitar. And that was the way things seemed to be going. And at that point, rock and roll had not yet become a nostalgia industry. It's interesting because I think in this book you can see how it becomes that. It really starts to become that in this period because for a lot of those artists, nobody's really buying their new records anyway. It's like the bad toupee era for mainstream rock in this period.
To that point, 1984 is 37 years ago from 2001. Yeah. Now, if I was in 1984 and I wanted to listen to music that was 37 years prior, that would be 1947. Which was
incredibly, yes.
That is the end of the big band era. Rock and roll had not even become a thing yet. It was just,
it was still rhythm and blues. It existed in it wasn't as straightforward as rock and roll would be.
The point is that it's weird that, and then I see this all the time when I talk to some of my young coworkers, they think 1984 was the bomb. They think, wow, what a great year it must have been for you to be out and about during that era. We see like Wonder Woman 84 film came out, very nostalgic look at that. We see Stranger Things, all sorts of an obsession with that time frame. And do you think the music has a lot to do with that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I would actually argue that the music is probably the main reason for it. Because frankly, the movies and the TV from that era haven't really held up, and the music totally has. So I definitely think it's the music. And I do think it's really interesting. I've thought about this a lot, too. It's strange that we're 37 years away from that year, but so much of that music is still vital and present in a way that music from 1947 simply was not in 1984. And rock and roll has everything to do with that because rock and roll steamrolled the past to a great degree. It rendered a lot of things just old. Not useful, not current. Nothing has really done that here in America in the last 30 years.
1984 wasn't all bad news for rock fans. Van Halen released their album called 1984. It reached number 2 on Billboard's album chart, stayed there for 5 weeks, right behind Thriller, on which Eddie Van Halen made a guest appearance with his guitar. The 1984 album released 4 singles, but it was Jump that was Van Halen's only number 1. In 1984, we had new technologies coming to being developed and were maturing, things like electronic music. And we certainly saw that with Herbie Hancock's Rocket. But that was like a huge breakout song. That was like everywhere you went, you would hear that song.
Yes, it was everywhere. It was a big MTV hit. It did well. It was a huge club hit. It got a little radio play, but I think just in pockets. I heard it a lot on the radio growing up, but it doesn't mean that everybody did. And Rocket was a big breakthrough because it wasn't a rap song, but it sounded like one. It was a hip-hop song because it had that beat, It had the scratching. It was very consciously a hip-hop song. But it didn't have rapping in it, and that helped cross it over to people who were, you know, iffy about rap. And then the scratches themselves were just so musical, it was impossible to resist. And then when Herbie Hancock performs it on the Grammys in February of 84, that's when a generation of future hip-hop DJs sees scratching for the first time. And that makes a huge impact.
So, but Herbie Hancock, they created the video. People might remember the video had like the weird robot legs and some mannequins sort of coming to life through electronic steampunk kind of way. That was a deliberate choice by Herbie Hancock in order to get his song on MTV. What was that choice?
The choice was to not appear in his own video because MTV was essentially racist. They weren't playing videos by black performers for the most part. Even up through 83, and 83 is the dam break year because that's when they finally relent and put Billie Jean on the air. It breaks the bank. It's the biggest video they've ever had. MTV doesn't exactly become a black music bastion, but it starts playing a lot more crossover hits, and the Herbie Hancock song is certainly one of them.
Among the hit makers of 1984 was Bruce Springsteen. Born in the USA was released, it would be his biggest commercial success. Dancing in the Dark found its way to radio airplay, and it was a big hit for the Boss. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 1984 was a watershed year for pop music, and one of the titans was balladeer Lionel Richie. Formerly of the Commodores, in 1984 he was riding a wave of hits from his album Can't Slow Down. Michelangelo Matos writes about Richie and this era in American music in his book Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. In 1983-84, we had this racial barrier in rock and roll. That was also a problem for the stations that were changing over in the format. They had a pushback on lot of the objections from the loyal listeners were like, this is, they used coarse language to object. Is one thing we can look at in 1984 is that started to fade away, that started to break down, especially with other stars like Lionel Richie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it broke down a little. I mean, this period that I write about in the book is almost like an oasis, because so many of the straightened radio playlists that defined the time right before it and would define the time right after it were suddenly gone. For about 2 years, the charts were genuinely interesting all the time, which was unheard of at that point.
Hello, is it me you're looking for? I can see it in your eyes, I can see it in your smile. You're all I've ever wanted, and my arms are open wide. 'Cause you know just what to say, and you know just what to do. And I want to tell you so much. I love you.
Lionel Richie is a great example of somebody who used the mechanism of crossover to his advantage, where he would make records that were aimed in one kind of playlist's direction that would then go pop. What Lionel Richie did wasn't simply crossing over from R&B to pop, it was also crossing over from adult contemporary to pop. He was making music for the middle of the road. He was a very streamlined, very mainstream balladeer. And in 84, he also had a small but significant crossover hit in the country chart with his song Stuck on You, which was, I think, the final single released from the album Can't Slow Down.
I'm stuck on you. Got this feeling down deep in my soul that I just can't lose. Guess I'm on my way. Needing a friend. And the way I feel now, I guess I'll be with you till the end. Guess I'm on my way. Mighty glad you stay.
I think it is hard for people today to recognize what a major star and influence Lionel Richie was for this time.
Yeah, he was significant. He was somebody who crossover often meant watering down your music. That was how it was taken to mean for a lot of black music fans. With him, it wasn't really about that, because he always did that. It wasn't like he suddenly buffed away the edges. There were no edges. Lionel Richie was about the most edgeless artist you can imagine. It doesn't mean he was bad, it just means he was edgeless, you know? He was, and sometimes he was bad, sometimes it was just real bathos. But when he was good, and Can't Slow Down is as, the album is as good as he'll get, you know, he gets. You know, it's fascinating to look at what his appeal was and who his appeal was to. He reeled in a lot of older listeners, but it wasn't just appealing to them. It's funny because with Can't Slow Down, the title song and All Night Long, it was him actually trying to cross over to the kids. He was actually trying to like get the mainstream pop audience on his side, the younger listeners. He was trying to make club hits as well as like radio ballads.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
And simultaneously, we have Prince, who is coming in after Michael Jackson. He's presenting music that, I mean, I wonder if Michael Jackson hadn't had his successes, that if Prince would have found the airplay that he eventually got.
Prince was battling those all on his own via Michael Jackson. Became what he became in the 80s, you know? Prince was doing that right from nearly the beginning. Those first early Prince shows were noted by the people who saw them, the writers who saw them, as being totally unexpected, because the records, the first two Prince albums, they have plenty of guitar on them. He could obviously play. But in concert, you know, that's when he and Desperson just wilded out.
Oh,
As a rock star, as opposed to just like a soul star with, you know, it was a different sort of imaging, and he was very conscious about how he did it right from the beginning. The other thing is that even prior to Billie Jean setting things off, or rather before Beat It, which became Michael Jackson's rock crossover hit, it hit number 14 on the rock charts, Little Red Corvette comes out before that. Little Red Corvette is the song that WPLJ tests what will become their new strategy out with. It's the first black record that they play. I remember really well being 8, 9 years old, but listening to the local AOR station in our car, in my stepfather's car, and Little Red Corvette came on. We nearly drove the car off the road because it was like, what is that doing out here? It wasn't that it didn't sound right, it was just that everybody knew you didn't hear black music on KQ, and suddenly there it was.
So it is astonishing that there was the awareness of the industry that that barrier existed and that strategies were concocted in order to wear it down.
Let me throw one other thing in here just quickly, is that that's a personal memory, and that tells you exactly where the barriers were. You didn't have to know anything about the business. You could be 8 years old and know that because the barriers had been that strong. The other thing is, this was the period of the anti-disco backlash. And for the record industry, for a lot of people, disco meant black music. It didn't matter what kind. Disco meant black for a lot of people. That's something to consider as well.
Right, and that explains the disco sucks movement, the backlash, and why that became such a thing. Really, of course, there was a lot of objectionable disco that was released. I do think that people need to recognize that disco sucks and all of that was strong racial undertones to that.
You know, there was also a lot of black backlash to disco. A lot of people reacted against disco so strongly that even a record like Billie Jean, where you can literally not describe the bass and drums of that record as anything other than disco, they're so patently, obviously disco. But nobody would have called it that then, for fear of reprisal.
Another crossover smash hit of 1984 was the dramatic comeback of Tina Turner. Her single was number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 for the year. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. More on the year that changed pop music when we come back.
You must understand, the touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than. Who needs a heart when a heart?
I've got cause to be. There's a name for it. There's a phrase that fits. But whatever the reason, you do it for me. Oh, what's love got to do? It's got to do it. What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's
listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, a conversation with Michelangelo Matos. His book is Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. He writes about the song that shook everything up, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. Crazy to now to imagine that MTV did not want to play Billie Jean.
It wasn't that they didn't want to play Billie Jean, it's that they had never played hardly any black recording artists on their channel before. Almost none. Their line in the sand was, it has to be rock. They were considering themselves a visual equivalent of an AOR station. The problem with that is that most of the bands that got played on AOR radio in America at that point didn't have videos. The British did. That's how MTV became a vector for the second British invasion.
Another area where it seems like there was a very different view on things in life in 1984, were gay and they were in the performing industry. Freddie Mercury with Queen. In the 80s, Queen was not really a thing in the United States. Very few people really enjoyed Queen that much because it wasn't played much. It basically was banned from our airwaves. Freddie Mercury was not out being a gay man during his career, but it was kind of like...
During his life.
Yeah, and so it was Elton John. It's kind of the same thing. He had a hit in 1984, I think Sad Songs Say So Much.
Yeah, and, well, he had a couple of hits that year, but yeah, he was still... You know, he was marrying somebody. You know, he was still closeted in a lot of ways. Yes, there are times when we all need to share a little pain. And ironing out the rough spots is the hardest part when memories remain. And it's times like these when we all need to hear the radio. 'Cause from the lips of a psalm or singer, people share the troubles we already know. George Michael was still not admitting that he was gay or not being forthright about it. There were certain ways, particularly with British stars, there was a sort of game that there was a gamesmanship aspect to it with the press, because the press all knew and they would hint at it, but nobody ever stated it outright. The big thing that happens in 84 with regard to this is Boy George. And Boy George has, in the United States, been this sort of anodyne, cute MTV figure. He's almost like, you know, a plush doll or something, the way people are, you know, find him adorable. And in Britain, nobody finds him adorable because they've all been slashed to ribbons by his sharp tongue. And then in America, during the Grammy Awards, he says in his acceptance speech that America knows a good drag queen when you see one. And in the States, that was that set off alarm bells. People were suddenly like, oh, he's actually gay. And it was a huge backlash. Huge. Like, their chart positions suffered after that in the States. A lot of radio stations, there was a great deal of backlash. There were death threats, all sorts of things.
Miss me. I know you miss me. I know you miss me, beloved. I know you miss me. I know you miss me. I know you miss me, beloved. I know you miss me. I know you miss me. I know you miss me, beloved. Bet you got a good gun. Bet you know how to have some fun.
But Culture Club was significant at this time. They were minting hit records, and today, yeah. I hear them when I walk down the dog food aisle at Walmart. Apparently, we got over it.
We got over it good, yeah. We got over it a while ago, or at least we got over that. But yeah, it's interesting. So much of that stuff really does still live in the public consciousness. We hear it out all the time.
Outside of that Hot 100, there were bands that were beginning to gel, and one of them that you write about is Los Lobos, and out of the LA, and how they came out with their How Will the Wolf Survive album in 1984. It was a change event.
In a sense, it was, because it was one of many signals that year that, you know, this punk rock, indie rock underground was so much more expansive than it appeared. That there was so much more kinds of music coming out of it, and so many styles, so much, you know, there was such breadth to the music. That was a good example. That album is a great example of that, because they throw all sorts of things into the mix. They exemplify that whole indie rock wave of that year. The Replacements with Let It Be and Husker Du's 8 Miles High single and Zen Arcade album.
Other things that stuck out in 1984, of course, Madonna had her breakout, especially when she was the opening act for the MTV Awards. And why was that significant?
Well, for one thing, she flashed her underwear on the camera, which, you know, set off a tizzy for a lot of people. It certainly got her name in the headlines, even beyond the fact that she was making records that were selling more and more by the week. Done with her second album, Like a Virgin. That album had been in the can for about 6 months at the point when she finally performed the title song on the MTV Awards. And the album would have come out earlier, except the first album, the self-titled Madonna album, kept generating hit songs. You know, they were gonna put the album out in the summer, and then Lucky Star took off, and they were like, well, we can't get in its way. And of course, they shouldn't have, because Lucky Star was a huge hit. So she was, like, champing at the bit to show off the new material. And here she is in a wedding dress singing Like a Virgin. You know, the headlines wrote themselves. The MTV Awards are really the first time America is seeing her do something other than being in a video. And she has all of that charisma. And that whole night is interesting because it's MTV's bid to to be part of mainstream entertainment rather than an alternative to it. And obviously putting Madonna first was like the ace maneuver of all time.
Do you think 1984 was like the beginning of the end for, we had a broad broadcast market, and today everything is so stratified, I don't think you could actually come up with music that is going to be entertaining for everyone.
Well, 84 and the surrounding period is an oasis in the ongoing march of what you just described. I mean, that's been ongoing since the 70s. 84 was a time when it felt like the walls were up. Suddenly, everybody could like jump into the middle if they wanted. The mainstream felt like an attainable place. I don't think it's that surprising to say that Thriller came along and suddenly everybody wanted to do something like that. It's like everybody heard Sgt. Pepper and went psychedelic for a year. Everybody heard Thriller and wanted to make an album full of hit singles. And some of the best artists of all time decided to do that. And there's a lot of riches there. And it's not just in the mainstream. It's the underground, too. Dance music is really finding its feet. 84 is the year Chicago House really begins. It's the year that Cybotron make the song Techno City, which names the genre of techno. You know, there's all sorts of things going on just in that year that would lead to other things. So, and the breadth of that has always fascinated me, and I hope I did it justice in the book.
Michelangelo Matos is the author of Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. Let's go out with the biggest song of 1984, number one on the year's Hot 100, Prince, When Doves Cry.